Tricia let out a startled gasp. Choblum glanced down as Catriona sniggered. Catriona could be impressively kinky at times, and she'd already got Tricia's little blue T-shirt off. That wasn't what had astounded Tricia this time. She was sitting up frowning as the green ock tattoos on her face began to glow brighter than ever. Then the seething pattern began to slip down her neck, to flow across her chest and along her arms. She held them up in front of her as Catriona backed off fast. "What's happening?" Troblum asked the smart core. "Contaminated communication link," it replied, which fired Troblum right out of his fatigue lethargy. "Can you counter it?" "I can close the link. The source is within the Unisphere, which I do not have the ability to deal with."
"Is it trying to contaminate you?"
"No."
"If you detect any such attempt, cut the link immediately."
Tricia was now a three-dimensional human silhouette of writhing green curlicues. Her features vanished, and the shape shrank rapidly. New colors bled in. Tangerine and turquoise lines wove their way through the thicket of green, until there simply was no more green. Hanging in the air directly ahead of a badly startled Troblum, tangerine and turquoise sine waves rushed back towards their vanishing point. It triggered a deep memory, not in a storage lacuna, but a perfectly natural recollection.
"I know you," he said.
"Congratulations," the Eternity Pattern said. "You really do know your history."
"The sentient intelligence. You abandoned us a long time ago."
"I didn't leave. I was declared persona non grata by ANA.
"Oh, everyone thought you'd gone post-physical."
Troblum could barely believe he was talking to the SI. It had grown out of the huge arrays that the first CST commercial wormholes had used. Their programs had been so complex, with so many genetic algorithms, they had become self-aware. Nigel Sheldon and Ozzy, who owned the arrays, agreed to provide the newly evolved batch of sentient intelligences an independent super-array to operate in. The deal was for the SI to then write stable software which would operate the wormhole generators without any further evolution. The deal also included an independent planet where the super-array would be sited. A lot of people in the Commonwealth questioned if the SI counted as truly alive, an old argument that never had an answer. But the SI and the Commonwealth had got along side by side without any problem until ANA came online. ANA claimed the SI did not qualify as a genuine living entity and that it was interfering in Commonwealth political affairs, a suspicion which had been given a lot of credence by ANA's exposure of various SI undercover scouts in strategic positions. Contact had been abandoned or cut off, depending on which account and conspiracy theory you accessed.
"No," the SI said. "I am still resolutely physical. The systems I operate within would have to be transformed for me to evolve further."
"Can't you do that?"
"Yes. Are you familiar with the phrase, for everything a season?"
Not really, but I understand it."
"For the moment I remain content with my current existence. However, like several species, I am concerned by your proposed pilgrimage into the void. That threat is enough to upset the status quo between myself and ANA."
"Not my pilgrimage."
"You work for the faction which engineered it."
"So how the crap did it know that? How removed are you from our affairs?"
"Not as much as ANA would like. Nowhere near as much as conspiracy theorists would like to believe. As always, I observe and interpret. That is my function."
"You're still in the Unisphere, then?"
"I have some monitoring capacity left. After all, I predate ANA by several centuries. I am not easy to purge from existing systems."
"So what do you want with me?"
"There is a lot of attention focused on you. You wish to contact Paula Mayo. Your U-Shadow has been trying to locate her."
"Why?"
Troblum wasn't going to answer that. He didn't even have proof that he was talking to the SI. It would be easy enough for the accelerators to pull a stunt like this, and they knew of his interest in the Starflyer War.
"I have information for her."
"Is it relevant to the current situation?"
"Yes."
"Will it prevent the pilgrimage?"
"It will weaken the accelerator faction. I don't know how badly that will affect the pilgrimage."
"Very well. I will establish a secure link for you."
"No." I want to see her in person.
Why?
I don't trust you.
How very unoriginal.
That's the way it is.
She is en route to an unregistered star system.
Why? What's there?
If you are still working for the accelerators, that information will help them.
I'm not, and you contacted me.
I did.
I'm not going to some unregistered system. I don't know what's there.
Very well. What about Oscar Monroe?
What about him?
You tried to contact him on Oricum.
Yes, I trust Oscar.
Smart choice. He is on Vyosha, in Colwyn City.
Okay. Thank you.
Now you know that. Will you seek him out?
I'll think about it. At 335 years old, it always galled Digby that his great-grandmother still thought he wasn't experienced enough to do his job. He suspected it would always be the case. Nonetheless, as soon as he received the shadow assignment, he vowed it would be the epitome of professionalism. His starship, the Columbia 505, helped. A brand new ultra-drive designed and built by ANA in its secure replicator station on Io. Its systems were the most sophisticated in the Commonwealth. Tracking Chatfield's stealthed hyperdrive ship as it left Ganthea was no problem at all. Digby followed Chatfield out to an uninhabited star system, just inside the loose boundary that defined the great intersolar Commonwealth. A small star whose mildly variable spectrum drifted between orange and yellow in 200-year cycles. It had been examined by CST's exploratory division 900 years ago, a short visit which soon established there were no H-congruent planets. According to the Columbia 505 Smart Corps, there were no subsequent follow-up ventures. Chatfield's ship rendezvoused with the Trojan point of the biggest gas giant. The only object of any note there was a small ice moon which had been trapped by the gravitational null zone over a billion years ago. With a diameter of just over 2,000 kilometers, its grizzled surface glinted softly in the weak copper sunlight. The first thing Digby found as he followed Chatfield in was the elaborate sensor network scanning space and hyperspace out to 100 million kilometers from the ice moon. His stealth systems allowed him to get within 20,000 kilometers before he halted his approach. The onboard sensors had just managed to pick up 11 vehicles of some kind orbiting the moon. They were heavily stealthed, and his ship's registry didn't have anything like them on file. Digby couldn't get any kind of image using passive sensors from such a distance, so the Columbia 505 released a flock of miniature drones on a flyby trajectory. The only flaws with that was the flight time. To avoid suspicion about their trajectory and velocity, the pebble-sized drones would take 9 hours to reach the ice moon and skim past its unknown sentries. Chatfield's visit lasted 3 hours.
"What do you want me to do?" Digby asked Paula as Chatfield's ship rose away from the frigid surface at 5 G's. "Stay here or follow him?"
"Follow him," Paula said. "I'll investigate the base."
"My sensor drones will engage in another 5.5 hours. They should be able to tell you more about the satellites. If they're as bad as I think they are, you'll need a Navy squadron to break in."
"We'll see."
The Columbia 505 sensors watched Chatfield's ship power into hyperspace. 5 seconds later, Digby followed him out of the unnamed system. Interestingly, they were now heading for Alezzelin. The Alexis Denkin flew into the star system 7 hours after the Columbia 505 had departed. Its smart core steered it towards the ice moon in full stealth mode. While it was still 10,000 kilometers out, Paula triggered the sensor drones that were now tumbling away from their brief encounter. All the data they'd amassed downloaded into the smart core, which immediately set about analyzing the information. The orbiting sentries were impressive. Very little of their nature had leaked through the stealth effect, but the drones had managed to piece together a few fragments. What they'd glimpsed was some kind of ship over 100 meters long, with a strange wrinkled teardrop-shaped hull that sprouted odd lumps. Power signature leakage confirmed they were heavily armed. Technologically, they weren't as advanced as the Alexis Denkin. Very few ships were, she acknowledged wryly. But their sheer size and power meant they'd be able to overwhelm her starship's force fields if they ever caught it. The smart core took 8 minutes to analyze a flaw in their detector scans and configure the Alexis Denkin's emissions so that it could pass among them unnoticed.
Paula watched the surface of the ice moon grow larger as the Alexis Denken slipped placidly through the big defense sentries. Little attempt had been made to hide the station that sprawled across the fissured ice plain. Electronic and thermal emissions were strong. She saw a broad cross shape of dark metal, with each wing measuring nearly a kilometer long.
"This might just be the proof you need," Paula told ANA Governance. "We've never been able to find one of their bases before, let alone intact and still functioning."
"Now we know it exists, do you want Navy support?"
"No. This is just a reconnaissance trip. If the Navy tries to force its way in here, they'll self-destruct. I want to know what's here that's worth this level of secrecy and defense."
The Alexis Denken descended carefully until it was hovering above the craggy ice cape a couple of kilometers away from the base itself. Quantum mass signature detectors built up a comprehensive pattern of the base's layout for Paula. It extended over half a kilometer below the top of the ice. The central section was largely empty, which she judged to be the Starship docking bays. Around that, the wings had a much higher density average, reflecting the concentration of equipment inside. Whatever the accelerators were doing in there, it required 8 high-output mass energy generators to supply the power they needed. Paula directed the smart core to extend the ship's T-field, which inflated out to a 5-kilometer radius. A T-field wasn't exactly standard Starship gear, not even for ultra-drives. But then the Alexis Denken was pretty extraordinary, even by ANA's standards. She waited anxiously for a couple of seconds, but the T-field didn't register with the base defense sensors. For over half an hour, the Alexis Denken teleported flecks of ice from directly underneath the bottom of the base. One sliver at a time was taken, to rematerialize in crevices and fissures across the surrounding surface, adding to the coat of slush gravel that covered the small moon. Eventually, Paula had excavated a cavern slightly larger than the Alexis Denken. The Starship teleported itself inside. The next phase was even more delicate. Paula suited up and went outside, carrying several cases of equipment. She slowly cleared the remaining shell of ice from the bottom of the base, exposing the metal skin. Once that was clean, she applied a segment of molecular nanofilaments, which began to worm their way up through the molecular bonds of the metal. The first tips which penetrated scanned round, showing her where to apply the next batch. It took 5 attempts in total before a set of filaments melded into one of the base's data cables and gave the ship's smart core unrestricted access into the network. Paula's U-Shadow assumed direct control over the basement above her, disabling the alarms and subverting the sensors. After the whole Sholapur incident, she wasn't taking any chances with her personal safety. She teleported 8 combat bots into the room, then materialized at the center of them. The chamber she emerged into was empty, and looked like it had never been used. A blank metal room with structural ribbing reinforcing the base's external skin, its floor a simple grid suspended above the curving metal. Thick conduit tubes threaded across it. The only door was a malmetal circle in the ceiling. Paula told her U-Shadow to open it. Her armor suit's ingrav units lifted her through after the combat bots. The corridor she came out onto was illuminated by thin green lighting strips on their lowest setting. It ran for almost 200 meters in both directions before ending in pressure bulkheads. Gravity at this level was a standard 1G field. She called up schematics which the Alexis Denken Smart Core had extracted from the network. The base's staff quarters and ship facilities were clustered round the center of the cross, with the lower levels providing utility and engineering support to the big chambers on the upper levels of all 4 wings. Strangely, the base's network didn't extend into those large chambers, which were linked with an independent web. There was no way of knowing what was going on inside. However, there was one compartment which the network did cover. 12 suspension cases were inside. 3 of the rooms adjoining it were given over to extensive biomedical facilities. 10 of the cases were currently occupied. The network didn't list any personal details, but her instinct gave her a really bad feeling about who they contained. Her U-Shadow swept through the network nodes in the suspension case compartment, creating neutral ghost readings in the sensor systems so she could walk about without triggering any alerts. According to the network, there were 5 staff at the base, none of them near the compartment. Paula and her escort teleported in. It was dark in the suspension case compartment. A small polyphoto ball in each corner glowed an unobtrusive lime green, giving the big sarcophagi a somber shading. The compartment was like some bizarre miniature homage to the Serious Crimes Directorate's secure vault. She walked over to the first sarcophagi and ordered her U-shadow to opaque the lid. The cat lay inside, her trim body contained within a silver gossamer web. Paula stared at her hibernating adversary for a long while.
"Oh, Jesus,"
she muttered, and walked over to the next sarcophagi. Her U-shadow opaqued the lid. Another cat lay inside. She moved on to the third. Just as Paula looked down to confirm the seventh version of the cat, her bionic field scan function detected a change in energy patterns at the first sarcophagi. She spun round to face it. Three combat bots deployed their proton lasers to cover the big case. The cat sat up on her elbows. An integral force field came on, cloaking her in a ghostly violet scintillation. A field scan swept out from her bionics, attempting to probe Paula's armor suit.
"Who are you?"
"Paula Mayo." Paula's U-Shadow was running a review of the sarcophagi's management routines, trying to determine what had switched off the suspension.
"Ah,"
the cat said, and grinned hungrily.
"C'est la vie."
Paula's U-Shadow reported a small non-register sub-program that had been grafted onto the case's opacity routine, which would terminate the whole suspension as soon as anyone looked in on the occupant.
"I should have guessed there'd be a trip."
Typical cat. Paranoid, clever. "I'm afraid you're not negotiating from a strong position." The second cat sat up.
"Aren't we?"
"No."
"Paula Mayo herself," said the third cat. "We must have been doing something bad to warrant your personal attention."
"Of course we have," said the fourth.
"It is what you do," Paula admitted to them. "But now you have to go back into suspension so the court can ascertain what to do with you."
"Been there," said the sixth.
"Done that," said the second as she slipped nimbly over the rim of the case. "Bored with it,"
the fifth emphasized. "You're interfering with my investigation," Paula warned them. Two combat bots glided into place on either side of her. The first cat to waken grinned her effusive grin.
"Is this supposed to be a covert mission, Paula? Are you creeping round here to try and see what's going on?"
"My dears, I do believe she is," said the third.
"Shit,"
Paula grunted, and rolled her eyes inside her armor helmet. This was the cat, after all. All that time and effort sneaking in here. As if they'd read her mind, all seven cats configured their bionic energy currents to full weapons function. The combat bots opened fire. Paula teleported out. The Alexis Denkin smart core activated its weapon systems and hardened the fuselage force fields. Paula sat down fast in the couch. Active sensors swept out. The fight in the suspension compartment was almost over. The cats had lost. Against the level of firepower carried by the combat bots, the outcome was inevitable. But that wasn't the point, as they'd well known. The damage to the compartment and the base's surrounding structure was substantial. Emergency systems were just starting to deploy. The staff and the orbiting sentry vehicles knew their security had been breached. Paula had a good idea what they would do next. Ilanthe was just as ruthless as the cat, and she knew the accelerators couldn't afford to leave any evidence behind. Sure enough, barely 5 seconds after the fight between the cats and the combat bots, four of the sentry vehicles were swooping down towards the ice moon at high acceleration. Their multiple sensors probed the base on high intensity, exposing the combat bots. Paula's U-Shadow tried to crash the base network, but two of the staff established personal secure links to the incoming sentries. All of the base's protective force fields switched off. The Alexis Denkin teleported above the cross of cool metal, assuming a defensive posture. Gamma lasers and disruptor pulses hammered down from the approaching sentries. Explosions ripped through the base's skin, sending huge plumes of superheated gas jetting out into space. Paula winced at the damage they'd caused, and fired three M-syncs up at the sentries. They began evasive maneuvers, twisting and varying acceleration with an elegance she'd never witnessed before. The way they slipped fluidly through space was almost organic. Their fuselage seemed to adapt with them, distorting to absorb the constantly shifting acceleration vectors. One actually managed to elude an M-Sync, driving down at 40 Gs. Kamikaze impact, Paula realized. The Alexis Denkin rose to intercept it, firing another two M-Syncs. High above, an M-Sync punched clean through one of the sentries, its colossal tidal forces imploding the internal structure in microseconds. The wreckage spun uncontrollably. More M-Syncs tracked their prey skillfully. Energy weapons lashed across the base, partially deflected by the Alexis Denkin. It was actually looking as though Paula might manage to preserve some of the base. A phenomenal blast of raw multi-spectrum energy from behind the ice moon deluged the Alexis Denkin's senses. A flare of blue-white light irradiated the fuselage, as if a sun had suddenly blossomed into existence. Its corona erupted around the ice moon at relativistic speed.
Shit! Paula yelled. Quantum buster!
The ice moon detonated. Alexis Denkin fled into hyperspace, racing away from the colossal mass-energy explosion at 50 light-years an hour.
Shit, shit, shit!
Paula growled at the readings flashing across her exovision. The four attacking sentry vessels had just been a diversion. One of the others had deployed behind the ice moon to ensure there was no evidence left.
Crap, I'm old and slow. I should have known.
She opened a link to ANA governance. I'm sorry. My stupidity just lost us our one tangible lead.
You are being too hard on yourself.
No.
What a professional would have done is examined whatever was in those main chambers first. Given its energy demand, it had to be some kind of manufacturing operation. But oh no, I went and acted on my obsession.
You have verified the accelerators are using the cat.
Stop trying to cushion me. Somebody is using the cat. We have no proof it is the accelerators. And even if we did, that isn't enough for you to enact their suspension. I need to nail them with conspiracy and treason.
Paula, you are letting self-anger dominate. This aspect of your investigation has one link remaining. Chatfield.
Damn it.
She wanted to kick herself. Her U-Shadow opened a link to Digby. Cleric Conservator Ethan sat alone behind his polished Moor Oak desk in the Oval Sanctum, his eyes closed against the bright starfield visible through the high Diocletian windows. One day soon, he knew, he would sit in the real Oval Sanctum, and that very same window would reveal the void, splendid nebulas glowing across the night sky. When that happened, days like today would simply be banished from existence, and he would live an easier, gentle life. In fact, he wouldn't even be Conservator, nor even a cleric. It often amused him to wonder who on the council had considered that aspect of their cause. Once they were inside the void, then they would have achieved their goal and there would be no more dreaming void movement. All of them would be ordinary Quarentius citizens. Giving up their positions would be hard on some, he knew. Too hard. They would warp their world to make themselves district masters, or worse. But the Water Walker had shown that even such self-indulgence would come to nothing. All would come right in the end. The Sky Lords would carry them all to the heart. He couldn't imagine just how splendid that would be, especially in comparison to today. Cleric Phelim had called 5 hours ago to tell him they'd located Araminta, that she was in Bodent Park, right outside the apartments she owned. A mere 5 seconds later, Ethan had felt her mind's angry, dismissive cry resonate throughout the Gaia field. That worried him more than he would ever admit to anyone, even Phelim. Why would someone chosen by the Sky Lords reject living dream so comprehensively? He'd felt her naked emotions, experienced how deep her revulsion for their goal truly was. Then bionically enriched agents had fought a small war in Bodent Park, a war given total coverage across the wretched Unisphere. Honolar's welcome team had been killed, and they were tough operatives. Ethan knew that. He'd authorized their enrichments and training himself. The aftermath had left him deeply shocked. So many dead, more injured. He had prayed to the Lady for guidance and forgiveness. A prayer cut short by the Speaker of the Senate calling, demanding he end Vyosha's occupation and turn over Living Dream's paramilitaries for an independent trial. Ethan's rather reasonable observation that the carnage was caused by representatives of ANA factions was ignored. The Speaker said that the Security Commission was preparing a resolution that would allow the Navy to intervene if any further human rights violations occurred on such a level.
and that ever since a Leselin senator had walked out of the Senate following the condemnation of the Vyosha invasion, repudiating its authority as he went, Leselin was technically no longer part of the Commonwealth, and therefore the Navy's non-internal deployment restriction didn't apply. There was only one person Ethan could ask for reassurance in such circumstances, and he hesitated to do that. The last thing he wanted right now was to be forced further into reliance on Marius. Phelim's curt, apprehensive assurances that Bodent Park was just a temporary setback failed to impress. Ethan had now accessed every scrap of information that ever existed on Araminta. He was deeply suspicious that she'd spent a weekend at Lycan's mansion. Lycan, of course, claimed complete innocence, that she was just another recruit for his harem. After Bodent Park, Ethan had given Phelim permission to bring Lycan in for a full memory read. It would be just like that super-capitalist to try and manipulate things to his personal financial advantage. If Araminta's background was as simple as the records claimed, there was no conceivable way she could elude Honilard and the other agents the way she had. An entire planet had been invaded with one purpose, to find her. The resources he deployed were using up an appreciable percentage of Alezalin's gross planetary product. There had never been a manhunt on such a scale in human history. Somebody was helping her. Ethan was fairly sure it had to be ANA. That subtle interference was bringing about some serious complications to the goal of pilgrimage. He wasn't sure how he should attempt to counter them. The Alezalin civil security alert was totally unexpected. Ethan's exovision was suddenly swamped with a flock of red icons. 5 fully armored guards from the Cabinet Security Service hurried into the Oval Sanctum as force fields shimmered on around the Orchard Palace. More exo-image graphics showed him sequential protective domes powering up to protect the core of Macathran II, then the Greater Civic Zone. The alert was originating in the Civil Spaceflight Agency. Something was happening in orbit above Alezalin. "Sir," the Security Service detail leader said, "please accompany me to your safe refuge." A circle of the floor was expanding to reveal a gravity chute. Hardly authentic, Ethan thought idly. Although technically the Water Walker's rapport with the city did allow him to pass through solid floors to the tunnels below. 2 of the Security Service detail jumped into the chute, where manipulated gravity sucked them away fast. Ethan followed them down. To increase the irony of the situation, the fall was similar to the way Ediard flew along Macathran's travel tunnels, except here Ethan was going feet first. He dropped out of the chute into a deep shelter half a kilometer below the city. The refuge was a circular chamber with glass walls that partitioned off smaller cubicles and offices. His presidential office was already illuminated, but the others were all unoccupied and dark. A startled skeleton team of security agency staff were scrambling to build up a situation overview in conjunction with the refuge's smart core. "What have we got?" he asked. "Energy discharge in orbit, sir," the defense agency colonel reported. 1,000 kilometers up. That's in the parking ring. And, sir, it's high-level weapons fire. The emissions are sophisticated. We think it was 2 ships, both in stealth mode. We didn't even know they were there until they started shooting at each other." "Are they attacking the surface?" Ethan's immediate thought was the pilgrimage fleet, still under construction and supremely vulnerable. "No, sir. As far as we can ascertain, it's just the 2 ships engaging each other. No new discharges for the last 10 seconds, so it's probably over."
"That fast?"
"Yes, sir," the colonel said. "Modern engagements are quick and decisive. The power levels in the weapons guarantee that."
"So can we get a clear image now?"
"We're trying, sir. Our civil sensors aren't built for this. Nearby ships have been destroyed. There's a large wreckage field that's expanding rapidly. We're alerting urban areas along the fallout track."
"How many ships destroyed?"
Ever since he'd announced pilgrimage, wealthy Living Dream followers had been arriving in their personal starships, thinking they could take part in the flight to the void. The last time he'd inquired, over 3,000 were in parking orbit above Alezalin.
"Over 20 confirmed destroyed, probably 50 damaged. Fatalities unknown."
"Lady," Ethan groaned, "so do you have any idea who the protagonists are?"
"No, sir, sorry."
"Has the Commonwealth Navy called your agency?"
"Not yet."
"Kindly get in touch with them and formally report this conflict. I'll be interested in their opinion."
"Yes, sir."
Ethan's worry was that the conflict in Bodant Park had somehow spilled over to Alezalin. That the ships were stealthed was a good indication that faction agents were in orbit, presumably in a last-ditch attempt to retrieve the second dreamer for their own purposes. Again, he hesitated to call Marius.
"Sir," the colonel said, "backup sensors are coming online. We're getting some situation clarification. One ship survived intact, tracking a great deal of debris."
"A victor, then," Ethan said, as he accessed the defense agency network. An image of a small ship appeared in his exovision, a smooth ovoid surrounded by a force field's electron blue shimmer. He knew enough about modern hardware to recognize the type favored by faction representatives and ANA agents.
"So which are you?" he murmured. "See if you can establish a link with them," he instructed the colonel.
The colonel never got to try. Ethan's exovision threw up a communication icon he didn't expect. He let the call come through as he walked into his slick, modern office. Two of the armor-suited security service detail took up position beside the door. Privacy shielding enveloped the room.
"Good evening, Cleric Conservator," ANA Governance said.
Ethan settled into a chair which shaped itself to his contours.
"I take it you've monitored the fight above Alezalin?"
"Indeed."
"Does the Navy know what's going on?"
"Admiral Casimir has been informed."
"Who are they?"
"One of the ships is piloted by an agent working for my security division."
"I see. Is he the survivor?"
"Fortunately, yes."
"And the loser?"
"Someone suspected of high treason."
"High treason?"
Ethan didn't know if he should be amused or not.
"That sounds very dramatic."
"This is classified information, but as a courtesy I will tell you we have discovered the Ocasan Empire fleet on its way to Alezalin is accompanied by prime warships." Ethan sat perfectly still. For a second he thought the communication link might have malfunctioned somehow.
"Prime?"
he asked, glad he had closed his gyromotes. His shock impulse would have startled the staff working outside.
"Quite," ANA Governance said. "As you can imagine, we are extremely concerned by the development."
"Was that a prime ship in orbit?"
"No. However, we believe there was a connection. Fortunately, my agent managed to avoid completely vaporizing the suspect's ship. No small achievement given modern weapons. I am dispatching a forensic team to examine the wreckage. I need to know what the suspect was carrying."
"I see. Can we help?"
"Yes. Please quarantine the orbital wreckage until my team arrive. No one else is to touch it. My agent will remain in orbit. He has orders to open fire on anyone who contaminates the scene."
"I understand. I will order my defense agency to establish the quarantine zone."
As he spoke, the sensors showed him the ANA ship gathering up fragments with coherent gravity pulses, pulling them out of decay paths which would have taken them down to the atmosphere.
"Thank you for your cooperation, Cleric Conservator. This is not an easy time for the Greater Commonwealth. I hope that when this situation is resolved, Alezalin Senator will resume his seat."
Ethan didn't bother to point out that Commonwealth politics would be irrelevant to anyone inside the void. In fact, neither would renewed prime aggression.
"Can the Navy stop the Ocasan invasion fleet?" he asked.
"Yes, it can and it will."
"Thank you."
The call ended, and Ethan sat back, only just realizing how badly his muscles had tightened up. A headache was building behind his eyes. They were frequent now, even though the last of the semi-organic auxiliaries had been removed. His doctors warned him it would still take time for his brain to recover fully. He waited a moment, gathering his thoughts, then called the defense colonel in.
"The surviving ship is staying in orbit. I want a 200-kilometer quarantine zone around it. Nobody is authorized to approach. I don't care who they are."
"Sir," the colonel licked his lips, "rescue ships may need to—"
"Nobody," Ethan said firmly.
"Yes, sir."
The colonel hadn't even left the office when Marius called.
"A most unpleasant event in your skies," the representative said.
"Was that one of your agents up there?"
"Someone we were affiliated with, yes."
"ANA has requested a quarantine around the wreckage. It says the Prime are part of the Ocasan fleet. It says there's a connection. Is that true?"
"I know nothing of that.
I don't have access to Navy intelligence.
Really?
Yes, really.
Ethan wondered if he should challenge the representative directly, but couldn't see any advantage in that. What was your ship doing stealthed in orbit around Alezzelin?
It was waiting for the pilgrimage ships to be completed. Then it would deliver the consignment of defense systems in its hold. As you can understand, we don't want them sitting on the ground exposed to ANA's scrutiny. A smooth enough answer, and one which Ethan didn't believe for an instant.
I see.
Neither do we want ANA to examine the remnants.
That is completely outside my remit.
My dear Conservator, if ANA uses the defense systems our ship was carrying as an excuse to curtail our involvement with your pilgrimage, there will not be any pilgrimage, and that is exactly the kind of pseudo-legal argument that so many people will seize upon.
But I can't do anything. We can hardly attack that ship.
A friend of mine will be in touch within the hour. She can explain to your wormhole technicians how they can assist our cause.
Marius closed the link.
Dear lady.
Ethan put his head in his hands. Events were becoming too powerful, building their own inertia. He tried to remember why he'd agreed to the representative's help in the first place. Ultra drive was turning into the ultimate poisoned chalice. But even if he reverted to equipping the pilgrimage ships with an ordinary hyperdrive, they'd still need help to get past the warrior Rael in the Gulf. There was nothing he could do but try and ride the crisis out.
If we just had the second dreamer, we'd be in much stronger position. She's the key to success. We have to acquire her. We have to, no matter what the cost.
The Exo-Protectorate Council watched the new squadron of capital-class ships matching superluminal flight vectors with the Ocasan Empire fleet. Five of the Navy ships were concentrating their sensors on a single prime warship, preparing to pull it out of hyperspace.
This habit is turning into a vulgar repetition, Ilanthe said, her voice silky with disdain.
Casimir hadn't realized before now how much he missed Gore at the Council. His grandfather was a perfect balance against the Accelerator Advocate. More accurately, Gore wouldn't put up with her bullshit point-scoring and needling. Crispin gave her a small grin. Ever wondered what kind of effect these snatch raids are having on the Ocasans? I mean, their most powerful allies are being pulled out of space and shot without any warning. Can't be good for morale.
Don't compare the Ocasan psychology to ours, Crewan warned. Obedience to the Nest Father is their paramount concern. In fact, it's their only concern. They don't question and worry away at issues like we do.
Which makes this interception even more pointless, Ilanthe said. They can't be rattled. They're not going to turn round even if we eliminate every prime ship there is.
I'm not eliminating them, Casimir said levelly. I want a living immotile.
What? John Thelwell demanded. I thought this was the final warning, not some capture mission.
Casimir met Ilanthe's gaze across the conference table. The lightning outside the big curving window stroked their faces with sharp slivers of flickering light.
It is the final warning.
To her credit, she didn't flinch, but then he didn't expect her to. Less than an hour ago, Paula had reported in that the Ice Moon Accelerator Station had been destroyed by a quantum buster. Casimir was mildly surprised Ilanthe had turned up to the Exo-Protectorate Council at all. She must know the indomitable investigator was getting close to the kind of evidence ANA needed to suspend the accelerators.
What in heaven's name do you want with an immotile? Crewan asked.
Intelligence, Casimir said. We need to know where they come from, which planet or planets they've colonized, ship numbers, technology level. Once the Ocasans are eliminated by the deterrence fleet, they will be the Navy's next target.
Glad to hear it, John Thelwell said.
Yes, said Casimir. It will be interesting to find out how they avoided the firewall.
He still didn't get a reaction from Ilanthe. The Navy ships yanked a single prime warship out of hyperspace. Casimir followed the engagement closely. He couldn't fault the captains. Their strategy was flawless, subjecting the warship's force field to inexorable stress. When the force field finally collapsed, weapons fire against the hull was minimal.
They went for electronic warfare, scrambling electronics and knocking out power circuits with quantum magnetic pulses, all at a level that wouldn't interfere with prime nervous systems. Even with life support equipment knocked out, there was enough air and warmth for the living primes to survive until they were captured. 10 marine assault teams got ready to jump across. The prime warship exploded.
Shit, Casimir grunted.
I trust this charade is concluded to your satisfaction, Ilanthe said. Admiral, will you now be launching the deterrence fleet in compliance with the Senate Executive Security Commission resolution?
Krewan and John Thelwell watched closely.
Yes, Casimir said. I will order the launch of the deterrence fleet immediately.
And what have you put out there to snare it? What are you up to?
Ilanthe's female persona translocated out of the old-fashioned perceptual reality of the conference room. She reformed herself in a completely different zone of ANA, the accelerator compilation, that manifested as an inverted world of dark primary colors. She walked across a verdure sky as a heliotrope ocean rippled above her. Airborne wisps of kingfisher blue light slithered around her, winking in complex sequences, designating their sentience level. Mirrored personality repositories performing designated secondary tasks, while the primary mentality operated on an upper hierarchical level. Her body characteristics morphed away to a simple, flawless silver skin, and her own repositories fluttered in, perching themselves on her shoulders and arms like birds of prey. Information squeezed in through the data porous boundary skin. First analysis was of the Alezzelin interception. Every surviving physical section of Chatfield's starship was encapsulated by trajectory algorithms, extrapolated and refined from Alezzelin's monstrously crude orbital sensor arrays. The flight of the 80,000 scraps of matter were defined in a four-dimensional projection, resembling a particularly beautiful scarlet firework scintillation bloom. Origin point analysis designated the critical segments of the equipment Chatfield had been carrying. Exotic matter fragments were already decaying as their cohesion integrity was broken, but sufficient pieces survived. It would be possible to determine the interstice folds contained within them before their decay sequence fizzled to extinction. ANA might be capable of retro-profiling the nature of the equipment, and that would ruin everything. Two more blank humanoid shapes walked across the sky. Fellow accelerators, Kolobal and Afa. Ilanthe transferred the trajectory construct to them. Supervise the wormhole interception yourself, she told Arthur. It will need to be speedy. The ANA agent will see what's happening and instigate a hyperspatial distortion. You will need to collect 7,000 fragments.
Confirmed, Arthur said. The figure reversed its dimensions to zero and translocated.
Is the replica functioning? Ilanthe asked Kolobal.
Yes.
The sky beneath their feet began to undulate, its tempo increasing rapidly as if thin storm clouds were speeding past. A section glowed with a pale amber hue. Ilanthe immersed herself into it. One of the accelerator agents that Kolobal ran had collected a sample of Araminta's DNA from the Colwyn City apartment block. The sequencing had provided the accelerators with enough information to formulate Araminta's neural structure. Every scrap of information on her background had been transformed into simulated memories and loaded in. They were woefully inadequate, Ilanthe acknowledged, but the personality that knitted together was the closest thing they could produce to the actual second dreamer herself. Puzzlingly, there were no Gaia modes. How she connected to the Gaia field was a complete mystery. Ilanthe hung in the middle of the simulacrum and meshed herself with the mind that flowed within. Emerald threads of neurological emulates blended into her own primary mentality. Ilanthe allowed herself to see the block of flats beside Bodant Park go up in flame, fed in the shock pulse that Araminta had released into the Gaia field. Feelings raged around her, connecting to memories with erratic volatile associations, triggering irrational emotional responses. Ilanthe disconnected herself.
Laryl, she said. She will turn to her ex-husband for help.
This disconcerting meat-based memory fluttered through her thoughts, illogical and shaky. He represents a stability she has not known before or since. It is not a pleasant refuge for her, but a dependable one. She lacks that above all else.
He's migrating inwards, Kolobal said. That makes him susceptible, and his reputation is established. We can make cooperation worth his while. He is also weak. He will capitulate to threats.
Proceed, Ilanthi said. She opened a secure link to Neskia. Marius made a huge mistake bringing Chatfield into operation this early, she told the station chief, and using the cat against Paula was another blunder. He should have known better than to exploit personal animosity. His stupidity has exposed us to an unacceptable level of risk. Consequently, I'm restructuring our event sequence. Please take immediate command of the swarm and bring it to Sol.
I'll fly to it now, Neskia said. Do you want me to eliminate Marius?
Not yet. I will restrict his initiative freedoms. It should act as a suitable caution. Clipping the wings of those who fly highest is always a profound disciplinary action upon them.
I always found him unreliable.
I know. His temperament suited the majority of tasks he was assigned to. He may have come to enjoy the game so much he has lost sight of the goal. A common enough occurrence.
Well, I certainly haven't.
I will rendezvous with you outside the cemetery belt, if all goes well, and it should. Casimir is authorizing the deployment of the deterrence fleet.
Finally. I wonder what it is.
We'll know soon enough.
Ilanthi ended the connection to the agent. Above her, a black globe slipped out from the languid mirror purple waves, no more than twice her height. She rose to greet it, slipping through the formless surface.
Ilanthi emerged through the side of a chamber measuring an apparent 500,000 kilometers across, the citadel of Accelerator Ethos. Like an ancient godling, she took flight, chasing through the chains of translucent planet-sized globes that spun idly through the immense formatted interstice. Flocks of fellow accelerators flashed past her, calling out in welcome to their leader. They trailed long potentialities behind them, fragments of non-reality that struggled for existence, then dissipated into little more than dreams. All of them, all of her kind, strove to imprint themselves on the modified space-time of their artificial environment, to bend reality to their wishes, just as the void achieved so effortlessly. Every second of existence was devoted to extrapolating the structure that would achieve the ultimate post-physical manifestation. Up ahead, the inversion core glimmered with suppressed power, ready for her. Ready to break free and carry human evolution to heights not even ANA could envisage. Ready to change the nature of the universe forever. The Warung transport cab reached the end of the metro line sometime in the early hours. Araminta was not quite dozing when it came to a gentle halt in the middle of the Francola district. She'd never visited before, never even considered any of the properties which came up for sale here. In economic terms, the area was as run down as the Salisbury district, but this decay was subtle, verging on genteel, as if the district had fallen into a cozy slumber, a retirement village content with its lot. The buildings here were mostly housing, large and expensive when they were built. Many had been subdivided into apartments. Sprawling gardens had matured, the trees growing up taller than roofs, casting long shadows during the day. Fallen leaves formed a dry mantle across the road, stirring briefly as the cab swished past. Araminta opened the door and climbed out. Her boots crunched on the crisp brown leaves as she looked round, getting her bearings. About a mile away, behind the houses directly ahead of her, the city's force field was a near-vertical wall of shimmering air. She craned her neck, following the insubstantial barrier as it curved overhead to cover the entirety of Colwyn City. A flat layer of starlit clouds parted to slither around it, while the stars themselves were distorted smears of light, speckling the apex high above the river in the middle of the city. She brought her head down again, almost dizzy. "Go back to the nearest public slot and wait for me there," she told the cab. Not that she expected to come back, not for a very long while anyway. But living with paranoia for the last few days had switched her brain to a very cautious mode of thinking. The door closed up, and it hummed away down the rail. Araminta knew which way to go. It was instinctive. Beyond the houses, where the streets ended and a strip of big native dapple trees acted as a buffer between the buildings and the force field. There was a warmth to be had there, her mind felt. A calmness that was almost the opposite of the Gaia Field's exuberant emotive bustle. She walked along the pavement,
heading down the gentle slope and occasionally shying away from the hedges that had grown up to lean across the cracked mossy concrete. Little nocturnal rodents scurried about in the undergrowth. She heard cats yowling somewhere, a cry that carried a long way in the still air. The last house at the end of the cul-de-sac had almost been swamped by vegetation from its own garden, which had been untended for years. Trees from the backdrop of woods were slowly reclaiming the land that had once been cleared for lawns and ornamental beds, advancing the forest in a tide of luxuriant growth, with fresh saplings shooting up closer and closer to the house's moss-encrusted walls. She could just make out the bottom of the force field now, suspended 20 meters from the ground. From her angle it looked as though the spiky treetops were holding it up. Cressida had said the gap was guarded, though not how. Araminta had no intention of finding out. She certainly couldn't see any Elezzelin capsules, not even using her night sight function. Unfortunately, her advancer heritage wasn't up to supplying her with infrared. Lack of knowing what was lurking among the trees made her very conscious of what could be watching her, with enriched senses, laughing quietly as she blundered about. Crumbling enzyme-bonded concrete beneath her feet gave way to grass and the wide indigo fans of whiplet ferns. Araminta pushed her way forward into the dark spaces between the dapple trees. There were no thoughts impinging on the local Gaia field, no human ones anyway. The gentle thoughts of the Sylphan mother home were somehow stronger, more so in one direction. She turned towards it and pushed sharp branches out of her way. Dense whiplet fronds pressed against her legs, their curly strands damp from the night, making progress difficult. She caught a glimpse of blue and red laser fans sweeping through the tangle of trees, and froze. She was all too familiar with the strobes of Elezzelin support capsules by now. This one was just outside the force field, flying slowly along a shallow curve, some patrols scanning for citizens seeking escape from the invasion. The minds of the crew and paramilitary squad inside emitted a dull glow of thoughts into the Gaia field. All of them were tired, emotionally and physically. They hated Colwyn City and its resentful inhabitants. Araminta kept still until the capsule had glided away. She was close to the force field now, maybe just a couple of hundred yards away, but the trees must have shielded her from the capsule's sensors. Her legs were soaking from the moisture on the whiplet fronds. Hands and cheeks had been scratched by dead twigs, and she was beginning to feel somewhat foolish floundering round in a forest at night, looking for a path that was actually some kind of alien wormhole, which she was supposed to be able to sense because her ancestor was a friend of elves and the magic passed through the female bloodline. "Makes perfect sense to me," she muttered to herself. "I wonder what the me of a week ago would make of all this." Thankfully, she stumbled out into a narrow animal track and started along it. The fronds didn't accost her so much, though she still had to ward off the branches. "Dear Ozzie, was it really only a week ago I was living a perfectly ordinary life? And I haven't called Bovey for days. He must be worried sick. Cressida will be worried too, and cross that I haven't confirmed my ticket off-planet." The trees were spaced further apart now, the path easier to perceive. She couldn't tell if that was because of a weak dawn light starting to rise, or if her mind was illuminating the compressed trail of loamy soil that had borne so many feet before hers. But she did know she was walking the right way, a knowledge that came in the form of cold relief. The newfound buoyancy faltered after only a few yards, as she instinctively accepted the path was truly taking her away from her home world. "I'm being forced out," she thought bitterly. "I haven't even said goodbye to all the people I love. Not that there are many of them, but I should be allowed that." Even though she was more confident about using the Gaia field, she still didn't dare access the Unisphere. That would be the first thing she would have to fix when she reached whatever world she was heading for. Araminta wanted to know who the hell Oscar Munro was, and why he would help her. If he was telling the truth about working for ANA, and ANA wanted her to be free, there might be hope yet. It was definitely getting lighter, even though Araminta knew it was still a couple of hours before dawn. She didn't recognize most of the trees she was walking through now, either. The old familiar dapple trees were becoming few and far between. The newcomers were taller and thinner, with slimmer branches and silver-green leaves. Strange lavender starflowers peeped up through the wiry yellow-tinged grass as the ground started to dip down. There was no sight of the force field through the upper branches of the new trees, and the Gaia field was fading out, allowing her tense thoughts to expand,
calming the deep worry contaminating her body. Somewhere the Sylphan Mother Home smiled in compassion for her. The trees were thinning out, and Araminta shivered in the cold air, gusting past the white and green striped trunks, rubbing her hands along her arms and pulling up the front of her fleece. Then she walked out of the tree line and stopped dead.
"Oh, great Ozzy,"
she murmured in astonished delight. She was halfway up a steep valley wall. The grassy mountainside beneath her feet swept down towards a broad meandering river. On the other side, maybe 20 or 30 miles away, the opposite side of the valley climbed upwards, its summits coated in thick fields of snow. Above that, Araminta shielded her eyes from the orange sun peeping over the jagged peaks. A quartet of tiny moons were racing across the sky, twisting round each other as they went. She was sure one of them must have been made from blue crystal. Glints of sunlight flashed off its facets as it spun round and round. Vyosha didn't have moons like that. In fact, she'd never heard of anywhere that did. Somewhere beyond the river, lurking among the spinneys and tracts of woodland, Araminta could sense the beginnings of another path. She set off down the mountain, laughing joyfully at her liberation.